always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life.
You may recognize this tune from a 1979 Monty Python movie called The Life of Brian, set in biblical times. This song urges a sunny outlook on life, while what's happening on screen is people are being crucified. The Life of Brian was banned in some parts of the UK. A few religious groups in the US also called it blasphemous and a crime against religion. The Catholic Film Office gave the movie its own rating of C, for condemned. But to this day, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life is the most popular funeral song in the UK. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Jokes about religion have been around since forever, as far as we can tell. We're talking about them now because a KU professor has just written a fascinating book about the whole gag. Ian Ellis, author of Humorists Versus Religion. Good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
Talk to me about The Life of Brian, then we will back up and discuss the book itself. Life of Brian came out at a particular moment in what you call the culture wars.
It certainly did. My book is built largely around a kind of historical sweep of conflicts between humorists and religion. Starts with Mark Twain in the 1860s when you've got Darwinism arriving on the scene. And there are other periods along the way, but 1979 is a particularly pivotal moment. You had revolution going on in Iran. You had the rise of Jerry Falwell's moral majority in the U.S. You had.
Can you, for people who may like, we probably have some listeners who do not remember that. Can you share, you know, Jerry Falwell, moral majority? What are you talking about?
Well, the evangelical Christians that constitute such a large proportion of the religious in America had largely kind of been somewhat underground and separatist. Their ideas of religion were that religion shouldn't mix with politics, and that tended to be the pervasive strain up until the mid-70s when a Southern Baptist preacher called Jerry Falwell decided that if he wanted to have prayer in schools, if he wanted to ban abortion, if you wanted to deny the ERA, Equal Rights Amendment for women, then he would have to get in the political game. In the late 70s, Ronald Reagan was standing for president and realized that it was going to be difficult for him to win. So one might say they made a deal of sorts, Falwell and his supporters, with the Reagan administration. And obviously, as we've seen, religion in politics has remained ever since. And I think it was about 85% of evangelicals voted for Donald Trump in the last election. So we see that withdrawal that used to exist in that community is now intimately engaged at all levels. If you look at the cabinet currently of the Trump administration, you see that it's full of evangelical Christians that are veterans from that era of the late 1970s. So this film came in the context of an awful lot of political conflict going on both here and abroad.
And so in the British context was what again?
Well, in Britain at the time as well, you had, thankfully over here, you have the First Amendment, but in Britain we actually had active blasphemy laws at the time. And just a couple of years before this film came out, a publisher of a book of poetry was actually convicted of blasphemy and imprisoned for publishing a somewhat racy satirical poem.
So Life of Brian was a risky movie to come out. I mean, to watch it today, there's the silliness is,
right.
It's hard to, that's like the first thing that I would say about it. It's very, very silly and playful, but it was a huge risk, it sounds like.
It was risky and it was resisted. Every time they got funding, the people who funded had to back out under various pressure. We had a woman at the time called Mary Whitehouse who was almost like a kind of citizen censor who had an awful lot of power in Britain to basically influence these kinds of things of making sure funding wouldn't go to controversial projects. Actually ended up that the Python team, in order to get this film made, got the funding from George Harrison from the Beatles.
Wow. What inspired you to study this particular relationship between humor and religion?
Probably my love of some of the comedians and humorists within. Mark Twain's one of my favorite writers. George Carlin's one of my favorite stand-up comedians. I've always been a big fan of The Simpsons cartoon sitcom. So anyone who obviously follows these comedic outlets, genres, forms, exponents will come across their various engagements with religion. Also music as well, I should say, because that's where most of my studies were before, humor and music. So I guess I came to this subject through humor, and I certainly come at it with more knowledge of humor than I do of religion. I certainly don't pretend to be some theologian.
What is your relationship with religion, if you don't mind my asking?
I'm an atheist.
So you officially start with Mark Twain, but you mentioned that religious humor can be traced back as far as the ancient Greeks.
Right. Yeah, Juvenal, Aristophanes in Greek times, Juvenal during Roman times. These were early examples of humorists that took on religion in satirical fashion. So there's always been this antagonism between the two. And one of my interests in the book was to examine not only the cultural phenomenon of this long-standing conflict, but also why there might be something at the heart of this antagonism. And it got me into some investigations of what the nature of being religious is, which has to do a lot with things like order, discipline, obedience, which in many ways is antithetical to the humorous mindset, which in many ways is all about things like incongruities, about liberation and imagination, things that are not welcome. So this antagonism has existed, particularly throughout all of American history. Much humor was banned during the early Puritan times because it was seen as to laugh was seen as the work of the devil.
You know, I can't remember which person you wrote about in your book who said this, but there was someone, I think it was the sort of disciple of Mark Twain, who had said that a religious person would not make a good comedian. Do you remember who that was?
Well, there's a, I don't know whether who you're specifically referring to there, but there's a philosopher and religious scholar who I've studied who very much gets into this, and I use a lot of his ideas. His name is John Morial. He's a professor, and he talks about the different mindsets of being someone who is religious and someone who's comedic, and he talks about the fact that in his mind, These are two incompatible mindsets. Now, this is coming from somebody who actually is religious, this guy, which I thought was fascinating. So I do get into that quite a lot in my final chapter of my book.
And it sort of seems to parallel this kind of colloquialism we toss around, this nothing is sacred, which is sort of it's a way of complimenting, really, a comedian, like, oh, this person, nothing's sacred. They'll go anywhere. Do you think, you've talked a little bit about the way religion works in your mind and what makes that kind of a little bit, to your mind and other people's minds, incompatible with humor. And we'll get into that more with some specific examples because I think it's maybe a little more complicated than that. But what about the way humor works? Do you have a sense of like how humor works?
Well, your nothing is sacred comment, I think, is very interesting in this respect, because one of the things that we've always seen from our more critical and daring comedians is their use of what's sometimes called comedic license, or a willingness to take on taboo topics that a lot of serious critics will not, and sometimes cannot, because oftentimes the means of exchange, if you try and communicate, isn't always very effective. But what humour has is it has certain tools in its arsenal, and that's one of the interests in my book, is studying what I call the rhetoric of humour, the way in which humour can make arguments and can expose hypocrisy and corruption in ways that normal rhetoric or normal communicative styles cannot.
And that brings us to Mark Twain, the first person you write about in this book. The first chapter is about him. And I believe he's the one who in this book says that humor allowed him to say things that would otherwise get him hanged, except that he was able to make people believe that he was joking.
Yeah, nothing can withstand the power of satire or something to that. Was something that he once said. And his most radical extreme anti-theist writings we didn't see until 2006. And that's because when he wrote them, he was so fearful that if he published those essays, that his family would be threatened. And his subsequent family members as well. So he actually promised that the writings that he did in his latter years, which were later collected into his three-volume autobiography, he said, "I'm not going to have this published until 100 years after my death," because he was so fearful. And one of the things he himself had obviously faced throughout his life was constant censorship. During his period, like Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is one of the most censored books in the history of literature, even to this day.
You know, Mark Twain, Missouri guy, and I was fascinated by the way the relationship between the Presbyterian Church and abolitionism in Hannibal, Missouri kind of shaped his attitude toward religion early on. I had never heard about that.
Yeah, the story of Twain with religion is just an incredible tangled web. He carried around so much guilt throughout his life. That's why a lot of his work, I think, in relation to religion is so poignant, because he personally suffered so much because he grew up in quite a strict religious household, particularly from his mother, and then later married a woman who was very, very religious and believed in practices of spiritualism. There was quite a famous spiritualist at the time, Mary Eady, I think her name was. And his wife was just so passionately involved with spiritualism, and Twain was always just torn constantly between the guilt that he grew up with, the heart that he had, the love that he had for his wife, that he wanted to be religious so much, but his mind would not allow him to. So it was just a constant tension, and he expresses this an awful lot in his writing.
Well, let's fast forward to someone who we can hear delivering his own jokes. We're going to talk about George Carlin, and he heralds an era of what you describe as angry comedians.
Yeah, George Carlin is an interesting figure because he was with us for, 50 years. He started in the 60s as a kind of straight-laced comedian and then transformed himself into this kind of voice of the hippies. And then later in his life, I guess when you think that most people would mellow, he really seemed to take on what I call the spirit of punk. And so you see 90s Carlin and the final years of Carlin, that's when you really see him just go raging against religion and particularly his own generation. He was such a generational comedian. So even as an old guy, I always see him as like a spokesman for youth. He's like a classic youth rebel throughout his life. And that angry, anti-theist comedy of his later years is some of his most powerful and certainly aggressive satire, I think.
Well, let's hear George Carlin on religion.
Religion has actually convinced people that there's an invisible man living in the sky, who watches everything you do, every minute of every day. And the Invisible Man has a special list of 10 things he does not want you to do. And if you do any of these 10 things, he has a special place full of fire and smoke and burning and torture and anguish, where he will send you to live and suffer and burn and choke and scream and cry forever and ever till the end of time. But he loves you.
That was George Carlin obviously getting an enthusiastic response from a live crowd.
Doesn't sound angry, does he?
Well, so the thing is, though, when he says religion, he means Christianity.
In that instance, he does, certainly. I think if you follow that sketch, he talks more in a kind of philosophical sense. I think it goes on to him talk about the fact that God's performance hasn't been too brilliant. And he talks about the famine and starvation, poverty and stuff, and says, I've given up on God due to his work performance. I prefer someone who can get things done, like Joe Pesci, he says. And so it does develop, but I don't think that he was ever specifically just anti-Christian. I think his attitudes towards religion were a lot more philosophical in relation to belief in general.
Do you think that humor is philosophical at its core?
I think it has many, many different components to it and many different approaches. One of the things that I discovered when you look into these antagonisms between humorists and religion is some of it is about belief, some of it is about the politics of religion, some of it picks on certain faiths more than others, some of it is more trivial. There are so many different approaches and different interests in relation to this kind of, one might say, facet of the culture war.
You know, there is a bite to what we just heard, and some might call it, like, mean, as far as, you know, puncturing holes in a belief system that brings some people a lot of comfort and a lot of meaning. What would you say about the mean factor?
I think it's a really interesting aspect to the antagonism that's gone on, because so much of it, when we talk about rhetoric, is your ability to be able to win people over and communicate and be persuasive. And I think one of the criticisms that's been particularly made of a group that's often referred to as the New Atheists, a group that emerged in the early 2000s, is that the tone is very aggressive, and some would feel is quite alienating to a lot of people. I get into this quite a lot in relation to issues of gender and the atheist movement, because the atheist movement is historically extremely male-dominated, as indeed is humor and humorists in general. There's an aggression oftentimes behind critical humor and behind the new atheist movement.
That the joke has a butt.
Well, it's satirical, it's parody. There are different types of humor that they use, but it's aggressive humor. That's what critical humor is. It's not humor just played for laughs.
Well, so I do want to talk about Lenny Bruce. He's, I think, I don't know that he's philosophically so different from George Carlin, but there is something very different going on. Should we listen and then we'll talk about it? Okay, so in this clip, this is part of this, like, long list he has of what traits are Jewish and what traits are goyish. Lenny Bruce is a Jewish comedian, and he seems to have more criticism of assimilated Jews, Jews who don't act Jewish, than he does of, like, people who are faithful and have held on, which is sort of different from what we've been just saying about the relationship between someone identifying with their religion and their ability to make jokes about it and be funny about it. We're going to get into that, but let's listen to Lenny Bruce's Jewish versus Goyish bit.
The Army is Goyish, the Navy is Goyish, the Marine Corps is Goyish, the Air Force is Jewish. Camel cigarettes, very Goyish. Salem's Jewish. Kent's Goyish. Viceroy's Marlboro is Jewish. Kool-Aid, Goyish. Very good. Instant potatoes, scary Goyish. There was a thing in Life magazine. There's a picture of this cat. He's up in the mountains. The rope around him and his air for candle cigarettes. This is big. His name is so goyish. It's beautiful. And here, Bob, B-Y-H-R-E. Try to say it. Bob, B-Y-H-R-E. Barber. It's so goyish you can't say it. Barber. And dig, it's a barber who, when he goes up to the Alpines to save people for nothing, he risks his life to save people for nothing. What Jew would do that?
Now, I'm Jewish. I can laugh at this. And I'm here to say I find it spot on also. Why is this different?
Well, may I just say, I don't think it's wholly different from George Carlin, but it certainly has its own distinctions, as you say, in relation to Jewish identity, and maybe expand that into issues of Judaism as well, which we could mention. But it might be noted that George Carlin, as a young man, absolutely worshipped Lenny Bruce, saw him as his primary influence, and actually shared a prison cell with him one night after Lenny was arrested, which he was many times. But one of the fascinations about Lenny Bruce, it seems to me, is if you put him in the context of the time period in which he was doing his comedy, because this was the late 50s, early 60s, and the stuff he was doing was extremely controversial in the era, and the guy got dragged off to jail oftentimes. A lot of people suggested that it was because a lot of the targets of his satire were against Catholicism, and that a lot of the police forces in cities like Chicago, where he was arrested, were predominantly Catholic. So he, towards the latter months and years, even years of his career, he would often be playing in halls where the entirety of the outside of the hall would be police officers just waiting for him to say something so they could drag him off. But as far as the Jewish identity issue, this again is very much, I think, important if one recognizes the context. This is a time period of an awful lot of Jewish comedians, but most of those Jewish comedians, in order to maximize their audiences and expand their audiences, engaged in, I guess what the expression often was at the time, British, not Yiddish, which is the idea that you you sublimated your Jewish identity and your Jewish slang in favor of being more accepted, a kind of assimilation strategy. Lenny Bruce was exactly the opposite of that. He was extremely Jewish, very proud of his Jewish identity. And I've heard a lot of people suggest that a lot of the comedy, one might call his ethos, his fascination with justice, with equality, comes very much from concepts of Judaic justice.
Do you think that the particular religion has to be understood to understand how the humor around it is functioning? Because I laugh 50 times as hard at Lenny Bruce, and I'm guessing that that's because I get it on a deeper level. I don't feel so much like it's too mean, which I kind of
you do might if you're a
little,
Catholic.
Maybe, but maybe also like I get where he's coming from, and I get the baggage he's bringing with it. And I don't know if I get the baggage of George Carlin's jokes as well, but I suspect that if I were a secular person raised Christian, I might get it differently.
Right. Yeah, obviously it depends on how the comedian actually addresses the religion and treats the religion. As I say, Lenny Bruce was an incredibly proud Jewish person, and most of the targets of his satire were not against Judaism. They were mostly against Catholicism, actually.
So
they probably wouldn't receive it with the welcoming arms that you do.
Is there? Well, and I guess I'm speaking about that bit in particular,
yeah.
And where he is talking about culture also more right. than religion. But is there such a thing as like, is there a strain of humor that makes fun of atheism?
I'm sure there is. It wasn't necessarily something that I particularly addressed in my book, although I did have the final chapter called Humor and Religion, which is about can there be more humor within religion, and can humor be a strategy that maybe will allow this the culture wars or the cultural divides to be narrowed. So as far as movements or comedic movements that are specifically against atheists, I'm not particularly aware of those, but certainly there are a lot of critical points of view. Some
what about
of which
Steve Martin? Steve Martin and Atheists Have No Songs.
Yeah. That's a good example. And I think again, he reflects a criticism that's often made, and this is a criticism that comes from other comedians as well, that sometimes the bitterness and the harshness and the aggression of anti-theist humour has been alienating, and a lot of people have critiqued that.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman talking with KU professor Ian Ellis. He's the author of Humorists Versus Religion, Critical Voices from Mark Twain to Neil deGrasse Tyson. Call 816-235-2888 to talk about whether jokes about religion speak to you or if people's most deeply held beliefs should just be left alone. You can also tell us about the humorists whose take on religion stands out to you. 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about humor and religion, how they mix, and why they often do not get along. Our guest is Ian Ellis. He's written a book on the subject. Hi again, Ian.
Hello.
So I want you to compare and contrast a few things for me, and then we'll play some more comedy. You're an academic, so I feel like comparing and contrasting should be kind of like in your comfort zone.
I've heard of it.
British humor and American humor, particularly when it comes to religion.
Well, I'm going to hedge my bets a little here and suggest that humor is both national and transcends nationality. The national tends to be in the details. The humor tends to be universal.
Compare and contrast political humor and religious humor.
Very similar. I think most of the humor that is leveled at religion, not all of it, as I say, some of it is philosophical or has to do with belief mechanisms, but I think most of the humor that's been leveled at religion has been because religion entered the political field.
Humor about mainstream religions and humor about religions seen as fringe.
Well, it's a lot easier, I think, to hit on the Scientologists and the Mormons, etc., because of the backstories. But these so-called new religious movements, many have become mainstream religions. So maybe it's just a matter of time in relation to the satirical sword.
Okay, well, let's, on that note, talk about Julia Sweeney. What do you think that people ought to know about her, who she is, where she comes from, before we play one of her bits?
She's an extremely important figure in my book because of something I mentioned earlier, and that is the male dominance of both atheism and humor in general. And what Julia Sweeney brings is a completely different style of humor, one that has an awful lot more traits of empathy. It recognizes the consolation that religion can bring, particularly for women. She brings, I guess one might call it the feminist adage of the personal is political. It's a very personal narrative that she brings to her famous Letting Go of God performance, which is, you can just tell it has such a different tone than you see from the likes of a Bill Maher or a Richard Dawkins or a Christopher Hitchens. She brings a lot more empathy to the table.
And it's about her rather than other people.
Absolutely. It's a very personal narrative about her struggle. She grew up in a very strict Catholic home, and it's essentially her journey towards letting go of God. And it speaks in many ways to a lot of features of her own personal struggle between guilt, logic, reason, and she was a biblical scholar as well. She went to Bible school in a way to try and stay with religion. And the irony was that when she went to these biblical studies, it just made her more and more convinced that she needed to move away from religion. And obviously, as far as women are concerned, they have a particular stake in these discussions, because they're usually the victims of a lot of authoritarian religions. So the fact that they constitute such a minority of the secular community is, something that the atheist community should be addressing more.
Well, let's hear Julia Sweeney, and this is part of her own journey, as we've just heard. It starts with something, some scholarship that was offered to her as she was struggling with her own belief.
They said, well, we also believe that if you're a Mormon and if you're in good standing with the church, when you die, you get to go to heaven and be with your family for all eternity. And I said, oh, dear. That wouldn't be such a good incentive for me. And I said, oh. Hey, well, we also believe that when you go to heaven, you get your body restored to you in its best original state. Like if you lost a leg, well, you get it back. Or if you've gone blind, you could see. I said, oh, now I don't have a uterus because I had cancer a few years ago. So does this mean that if I went to heaven, I would get my old uterus back? And they said, sure. And I said, I don't want it back. I'm happy without it. Gosh, what if you had a nose job and you liked it? Would God force you to get your old nose back?
And so I think, like, what really does intrigue me about this is that it's not about other people and what they believe. It's how the beliefs sit with her and whether they would work for her.
Yeah, that's the perspective that she brings that's so different than a lot of the other humorists that are studied in the book, which are operate more through what we might call a satirical model, one of mocking, one of ridicule of the absurdism and the contradictions and the various hypocrisies that exist in religious practices. Hers is all about her own personal journey. But within,
it's very self-deprecating.
It's very self-deprecating. It's very open-minded. It's very sensitive. These are words that aren't usually leveled at the likes of Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens.
Well, speaking of Richard Dawkins, we'll play a quick clip of his style of humor regarding religion, and then we'll discuss the difference. This is Richard Dawkins.
Planes fly, cars drive, computers compute.
It's an inductive argument.
if you base medicine on science, you cure people. If you base the design of planes on science, they fly. If you base the design of rockets on science, they reach the moon. It works. Bitches.
What's he getting at there, and how do you see this as different, a different style of humor?
Well, maybe if I can do it by going to defense of Dawkins here. He features in a chapter on, which I refer to as the Sci-Five, five scientists who have basically been trying to use humor against religion. And I think if you, like he, as an academic of evolutionary studies, biology, his more aggressive, assertive humour is not only comes from one of his own academic background, but I think also he, and I would hope others would be concerned, is a scientist who realises the consequences of religion when it comes to things like vaccines. We've got the anti-vaxxers that often come from religious communities. You've got the climate change deniers. We're talking about consequences that could lead to the end of the world.
It's
so
like very,
their stakes are high, one might say, as far as scientists are concerned, who often stay in their labs. But he's trying to take it outside and take them out onto the public stage. And I think that's a very noble and necessary avenue for scientists to take at the moment.
So he's coming at his humor from a science community perspective.
Well, he feels he's at war. He feels that science is at war. He feels that evangelicals used to leave science alone back in the 50s and 60s. We had incredible progress in space, in medicine, etc. But now we see a lot of that under threat. And it's almost like the people who own the public stage are the ones that can spread untruths, can spread supernatural ideals. You know, obviously this is affecting education when you have things like, if I can mention the Kansas 2005 intelligent design case, etc.
Yeah, but I guess, like, what I wonder is, these are sort of, some people could see them as extreme manifestations of religion. Religion, just as a word by itself, includes so many different things and so many different belief systems and so many different, like, degrees of relationship to those belief systems. You know what I mean?
No, because science isn't based on belief. It's based on verifiable evidence. And I think that's the antagonism, that's the heart between a belief in the supernatural and a belief on findings that are verified by evidence. The fact that scientists are so open about that they can be wrong because subsequent evidence can prove them as such, is something that religions take advantage of, and therefore often tag science as saying, oh, look, even they don't know everything about this, so maybe it's not true. They are able to muddy the waters in this debate. And I think people like Dawkins, Carl Sagan, Brian Cox, Bill Nye, and others are valuable people in relation to the importance of reason and the importance of evidence, the importance of truth. We're obviously in a culture right now where those things are all incredibly under threat.
Well, Ian Ellis, with us from KU, thank you for broaching this eternally sensitive and eternally taboo topic.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Ian's book is Humorists Versus Religion, Critical Voices from Mark Twain to Neil deGrasse Tyson. Up next, wrestling, or wrestling, whichever you prefer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'll meet you in the ring. In a dimly lit wrestling ring in Overland Park, a man dressed in tights and a silk bathrobe swirls a glass of wine, unfazed by the crowd that boos him, chanting words like wino and heel.
The connoisseur Niles Blanquet is shocked. And I'm shocked for a couple reasons. The first one, I'm glad you asked why. The first one is, it has been about 8 months since Niles Blanquet has graced you with class and sophistication. And I am ashamed about how much you fans have regressed to your uncultured, unclassy ways. I mean, Kansas City, you guys act like St. Louis fans.
Ooh. Comparing Kansas City to St. Louis, that is a low blow. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're about to give Niles Blanquet what for. His actual name is Craig Kieseman, and he's here with me now to talk about the resurgence of pro wrestling culture in the Midwest. What has gotten us so riled up? Craig, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, Niles Blanquet, where'd you come up with that name?
So Niles Blanquet was a creation from a promotion that ran in Kansas City a couple years ago called the National Wrestling League, the NWL. And through a group of their staff and meeting, we came up with the name. It was something that I was developing on the independent circuit anyways, was some sort of wine character. And they essentially, we put the flesh and bones to it with the name and kind of a look.
Why a wine character? Because you have a day job with a winery, right?
That's right. I own a Windy Wine Company. It's in Osborne, Missouri, and I'm the winemaker there. So I just thought in wrestling, your character is really an amplification of yourself. It should be to be a good character. So I thought, no one's really done a wine character before. How can I do this?
So. But he's what's called a heel, right?
Yes.
So he's like a bad guy.
He's a bad guy, so he's every personification of what you think a wine snob is and every negative aspect of that. And it's great because I can take my real life job and apply it to him. So.
And basically make fun of yourself, like a caricature of yourself.
Exactly. In the industry in general. So.
But like, that's funny to me that within the Midwestern wrestling world, that like the wine snob is the villain.
Oh yeah, well you know we're beer country here. You know we got Anheuser, and you know we're big with all the Midwest beer, you know, good old boy clubs. So wine is one of those things that, you know, we still, although it's becoming more acceptable in culture, it's still considered kind of a hoity-toity thing, and so it's kind of just fits in well with that when you play it that way.
So, I mean, I don't mean to sound weird here, but you appear to be someone who works out and specifically who lifts weights. But are you actually a wrestler or is it fake?
Oh, no, I'm a wrestler. I mean, in terms of, you know, I've been doing martial arts since I was 11. Of course, did football, basketball in high school, all that stuff. But I'm always engaged in tournaments and you've done MMA stuff before. So, yeah, it's not a stranger to me for combat. Wrestling's just more fun because it's more of a storytelling thing now. So it's something I can enjoy doing without getting permanently destroyed all the time.
Explain where the wrestling ends and the storytelling begins, or where the storytelling ends. Like, where is that line between real wrestling and, dare I say, well, okay, I won't say fake. I'll say theatrical wrestling.
Theatric wrestling. You know, it's apples to oranges. So what I've always been taught and what I always tell people is, like, amateur wrestling, collegiate wrestling is 3 minutes of intense action, and professional wrestling is 20 to 30 minutes of, you know, cardio. It's basically the endurance game of it. And there's a lot more interaction. Of course, you're trying to portray a story. You're trying to think. There's a lot more thinking involved, I believe, in the professional side of things.
Do you already know who wins?
Yeah, I mean, I think the cat's out of the bag. It's 2019. So, I mean, like, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, the cliche aspect of wrestling that, you know, is Santa Claus real? Is the Easter Bunny real? That kind of thing. So we don't have to really, you know, we still play up to the kids, but I think to the public, especially the fans now, because we're having a lot more of the adult fans getting back into wrestling, you know, we're not trying to, you know, insult anyone's intelligence. We're just trying to put on a good show.
So that brings me to, do you think that we are in, that you are part of a resurgence? You're saying that you've got more adult fans who are into it as kids. Like, is there a storyline there?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, wrestling's always kind of gone in waves where it's really popular for a minute, then it kind of sinks down and it kind of reinvents itself. And I think we're in an upward swing where an evolution is what a lot of people are calling it, but it's just a change in the dynamic of what wrestling is. So a lot of the old fans that were fans when they were kids are rediscovering it now because maybe it fell out of their life for a little bit. They lost interest. They got busy. But now they're at a point in their life where they can start watching it. They can start seeing again and get kind of bring back those memories, get intrigued and involved in those storylines a little bit more. So,
well, so you're with a league called Journey Pro, and I understand that they have quite the following in the Midwest. Walter Fulbright is with us from Journey Pro KC, and he does a lot of the production work to make these. Do you call them shows or matches?
We would call them shows for the overall production, and then individual matches make up the show.
Huh, okay. So that now that that is resolved, what is it that you think? What do you think that makes this popularity, like, come back? What do you think is going on right now?
Well, I think that, like Craig said earlier, I think a lot of people who grew up on it, people tend to sort of, they think it's uncool as they get into, like, their late teens. They're like, oh, I don't like this anymore. And then as they get actually closer to 30 again, they realize this is a very powerful type of storytelling.
Okay, explain that.
Well, of course, it is absolutely a combination of athletics, sports, performance art. And more than that, there's an improvisational nature to it. I think people who watch wrestling assume, okay, they know exactly how this is going to go from the very beginning the bell rings. They memorize this like a circus would, like they know the whole act. I'm not going to give too much away, but that's not how it works. You play to what works. You realize how your crowd reaction is going, whether they like you, whether they hate you, and you adapt on the fly. And so what makes this so powerful is that the audience becomes part of the performance. And there's very few arts where that's true.
So what do you think about the particular audience that exists for this in the Midwest? Are there things that play to a Midwestern audience in a way that you think, like, wouldn't necessarily work somewhere else?
I think yes, but actually we're trying to kind of go away from that. Like Craig said, I think the best way to grow your audience now is not to talk down to them, not to be incredibly condescending about what the traditional, like, let's put this over on them, let's try to trick them. It's much better to sort of work with them, and you'll find that you'll get people of all ages, types, income levels, hipsters, country people, whatever. It becomes a real variety.
Well, you know, I guess the reason I was asking that joke about, like, the St. Louis Kansas City rivalry. Like, you know the crowd here, and you know what's going to get this specific crowd riled up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the benefit, too. Like I said, we're coming off of 2 years of TV here in Kansas City and in St. Louis with the previous promotion. And, you know, you learn your fan base here. So, and it's different throughout the country. Like, we would wrestle. I would wrestle a different match here than I would in, say, Tennessee.
Explain that to me.
Just different cultures. So they grew up with different territories. Back in the day, wrestling was divided by territory. So each territory was set in different regions and they had different wrestlers and stuff there. So you have different styles that were developed and were presented to the people. And so they fell in love with those styles. And that's just the traditional thing. So like you'll find on the East Coast or West Coast, you'll find like faster paced, more high impact style wrestling. You go to Japan, you'll have this heavy hitting, what they call strong style style, where there's a little bit less on the storytelling, more on the actual toughness of the two competitors. And then like the Midwest, we're kind of the mesh all where we're more old school storytelling. We like to do a lot of the simpler things to interact with the crowd and kind of haze the crowd a little bit more with our interaction that way. So
can you tell me a story of, like, we were just hearing that you don't know, you basically know the arc of the story, but, like, there's a lot of improvisation that comes into the details and a lot of reading the crowd and what works and what doesn't and going with that. Can you give an example of a time where you veered pretty dramatically from a script just because of how things were actually playing out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's countless stories of, say, in a match, someone is supposed to run out from the back to interfere, and it doesn't happen. So what do you do when you're in that position where you're holding whatever gimmick it is you are, and you're waiting for this person to come up? It doesn't happen. So you have to be able to improv. Other things are things that you really can't help, like a rope breaking during a match. So you know, you're set with no top rope, and your finish is a top rope elbow drop, you know, so how do you improv with that, or how do you do that stuff? Or someone, you know, God forbid, but someone gets legitimately knocked out. I mean, because we are a hard-hitting sport. We're still a sport. We still connect. So someone gets knocked out. How do you finish a match when they're supposed to win and they're knocked out and you're trying to revive them and still be a bad guy? You know, there's lots of things like that that happen. So it's just that interaction, that improv is what makes wrestling so organic and so great for the audience to see, and the wrestlers too. So
how did you get into it? I mean, what do you love about it?
I always grew up watching wrestling. I loved wrestling when I was a kid. I have an older brother. I have a twin brother. So we all watched wrestling and lived in out in the middle of nowhere where we had a satellite dish. So we had to get, you know, our cable vision through that, and just remember watching it fondly. When I got into high school, we were pretty strong in martial arts, and my brother and I used to do like body slams on the mat, and used to make our karate instructor so mad because we'd be wrestling. So he introduced me to a wrestler in St. Joseph, Missouri, Sonny Myers, who was a 14-time Central States champion with the NWA. And he trained me. He started training me. I was 17 years old. 99 is when I started, and I just kind of fell in love with it. I didn't go into it wanting to be a wrestler. Never grew up saying, I think I could do this. It just kind of fell into it, and I just fell in love with it when I started doing it.
You know, Walter, what about you? What are your wrestling memories that inform you on the production end of things?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I actually did train to be a wrestler as well, but I was very, very bad. I did not have I went into it. I didn't really have the respect for it that I thought I did. I was 18 years old. I'd just been a football player. I thought, okay, you know what? I can't play football anymore. My knee's shot. I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a professional wrestler because that's easy, right? I'm going to go ahead and tell everybody it's not easy. But once I got that and once I learned that respect for it, I realized, like, just like I said earlier, what a powerful form of art this is. And even though I have had times in my life where I sort of walked away from it, it always draws me back. And I couldn't help it. Here I am.
What do you think draws you back? Because it sounds like you're not alone, like you're part of a whole movement of people coming back to wrestling.
I just think that there really is nothing else like it. It is a great American tradition that has survived the test of time, and it changes over time, and it reflects who we are culturally as a people, and it's something that connects us.
Do you have a favorite trick on the production end of things that you're willing to divulge?
Use as much lights and smoke as you can. It makes everything look way more dramatic.
Well, our time is up. Walter Fulbright, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gene. I appreciate you having me on.
And Craig Kieseman, also known as Niles Planquet, the wine-swilling heel of Journey Pro Wrestling, thank you.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
There is a wrestling show made up of matches going on tonight at the Kansa Hall in Overland Park. Go to Journey Pro's website for more information. And that is a wrap. You can find anything from today's show online later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. We have talked about religion, jokes, and wrestling, so basically everything. And if you want to hear anything from earlier in the week, those shows will be there too. Yesterday's conversation on the importance of Black cultural institutions is not to be missed. kcur.org/centralstandard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.